worked his way down the stairs, shaking hands and calling out greetings. Parade watching parties were in full swing on every floor of the house. Friends shouted expressions of support.
"Keep up the fight, Joe. Don't let 'em close you down. Hell with 'em, Joe, they ain't got no right."
And Joe told them again and again, "Don't worry, we're staying open. We're staying open." The crush of people on the parlor floor was so dense it was difficult to make our way through it. This was the first time Joe had lived in a house on the actual parade route, and as a result, his St. Patrick's Day party was an even bigger draw than usual. In the midst of it, Gloria, the housekeeper, was gamely showing tourists through the house at $3 a head, perhaps for the last time. Three middle-aged couples stood clustered around her, cupping their ears in order to hear her over the din of the jostling crowd.
"In the olden days," Gloria was saying, "the ladies used to sit by this fireplace, shielding their faces behind these beaded heat screens. You see, in those days, ladies' makeup was made out of wax, and if it got too hot, it would run down their pretty faces."
Joe led me into a small, cluttered room at the rear of the house. He took a sheaf of papers out of a desk drawer.
"Now here's my plan," he said. "I've had to come out of retirement to draft it, had to put on my lawyer's hat. Anyway, tomorrow morning I will go over to the courthouse and dump this legal rigmarole in their lap."
He handed me the papers. They were the incorporation documents for the Hamilton Turner Museum Foundation, which was described as a non-profit corporation whose purpose will be to restore the interior of the Hamilton Turner House through proceeds generated by a private, not-for-profit tour business on the premises. Joseph A. Odom, President.
"So that's it, plain and simple," he said. "After we deduct salaries and expenses, I can't say there'll be any proceeds, but at least we won't be in violation of any zoning code. As of tomorrow morning, the Hamilton Turner House will not be a private house. It will be a museum. So, if they still want to close me down, they'll have to close the others, too."
"Do you think it'll work?" I asked.
"It'll work until they figure out how to get around it. But by the time they do, I reckon it won't matter, because I'll be rich and famous as the hero of your book."
At that moment, appropriately enough, a flourish of trumpets and a crash of cymbals was heard from the passing parade. Chapter 20. Sunny. 2 weeks before his second trial was to begin, Jim Williams stood in the street outside his antique shop, watching three men unload a heavy piece of furniture from a large van.
"Easy now," he said.
They were lowering a carved sideboard.
"Up a little on the right."
"How's it going?" I asked.
"Business as usual," he said. "I mean that other bit of business."
"My trial? I haven't the vaguest idea. I leave all that to my lawyers. To me it's a giant bore.
Now that interests me."
Williams nodded at the sideboard.
"That's a very rare example of Georgian furniture. Black walnut. Early 19th century. The Regency details are extremely unusual. I've never seen anything like it before."
He spoke as if the furniture coming off the truck was his sole concern. In fact, the defense arrangements for his upcoming retrial had been in turmoil only a few weeks earlier, necessitating a change of lawyers. Bobby Lee Cook, for all his guile and resourcefulness, had not been able to free himself from a conflict in court dates. He was committed to represent another client in a federal case, and the federal calendar always took precedence over state-level cases. Williams, suddenly finding himself without a lawyer, turned to Frank "Sonny" Seiler, a prominent Savannah attorney and a partner in the law firm of Bowen, Williams, and Levy. Seiler was already involved in the case peripherally, having been retained by Williams in his defense against the $10 million civil suit brought by Hansford's mother. That suit would come to trial once the criminal case was settled. Now, in Cook's absence, Williams asked Seiler to take over the criminal case as well. At 50, Sonny Seiler enjoyed a position of considerable stature within the Georgia legal community. He was past president of the State Bar of Georgia. He was listed in the book The Best Lawyers in America as one of the top civil litigators in the country. He was also a native Savannian, and that was a major plus for Williams. Juries, especially Savannah juries, were instinctively suspicious of out-of-town lawyers. Bobby Lee Cook had been from Somerville, Georgia, 100 miles north of Atlanta, far enough away to make him a foreigner in Savannah. Seiler was not only homegrown, he had earned a place in Savannah lore. 30 years earlier, at the age of 22, he had dived into the Savannah River at the foot of East Broad Street and swum 18 miles out to Tybee in 6 hours against rough water and the threat of a hurricane.
"Sonny Seiler's been busily at work on my case," said Williams. "He calls to tell me about it, but I only half listen. He sends me letters, but I just scan them. If you think it would amuse you, go see him yourself and let him explain it to you. Then you can tell me, in a few well-chosen words, how you think my case is going. It'll save me the trouble. His office is right around the corner in Armstrong House, that big gray mansion I used to own at Bull and Gaston. I'll tell him to talk to you. Just make sure you see him after 5 o'clock. Any earlier would be during office hours, and he'd probably bill me at his hourly rate. I've come to know the ways of lawyers."
The corners of Williams's mouth drew downward.
"Tell him to give my best to Ugga."
"Ugga?"
"U-G-A, Ugga. Ugga's a big white bulldog. He's the University of Georgia mascot. Sonny Seiler is the proud owner."
Williams said this with a disdainful look.
"Sonny is very gung-ho. He's the university's number one football fan. He's owned the school's mascot since he was in law school in the 1950s. The current Ugga is the fourth in the Ugga dynasty. 25 years of Uggas and football. Sonny drives Ugga up to Athens for all the home games in a big Georgia red station wagon. The license plate reads Ugga 4.
The entrance hall of Armstrong House was a cavernous space with marble floors and a baronial fireplace. A full-length oil portrait of a British nobleman in a crimson cape dominated one wall. Beneath it, old Mr. Glover, the porter, sat sleeping in an armchair. A receptionist at the foot of a sweeping stairway whispered that I should go right on up. Sonny Seiler's office was a large, elegant room that had once served as the mansion's master bedroom. Tall French windows looked out across Bull Street toward the Oglethorpe Club. On the walls, where one might have expected to find portraits of the firm's founders, there were portraits of Ugga I, Ugga II, and Ugga III. Each of the bulldogs wore a bright red football jersey over massive shoulders. A black G for Georgia was centered on the dog's chest. Seiler was sitting at his desk in a white short-sleeved shirt. He was solidly built and had big shoulders. When I came in, he bounded up from his chair like a halfback breaking out of a huddle. We shook hands. He wore a ring big enough to be brass knuckles. It sparkled with 2 rows of diamonds that spelled out in big block letters, "Georgia, National Champions, 1980. I sat down across the desk. It was 5:45, but I got right to the point, thinking Seiler might have the clock running anyhow. "Will your approach to this trial be any different from the first one?" I asked.
"Hell yes," he said. "We're going to have a whole new game plan. The biggest mistake the defense made in the first trial was not facing the homosexual issue head on. Bobby Lee Cook thought he had an agreement to keep it out of the trial altogether, so he settled for a jury of old maid schoolteachers, and it was a disaster. He was double-crossed when the judge allowed those 2 punk friends of Hansford's to testify about Jim and Danny having sex. So I sat Jim down and said, 'Look, we can't make that mistake again. If we do,
Lawton will bring those guys back and send the jury into orbit the way he did last time. You've got to come right out with it yourself this time, in your own words. Phrase it gently and get the shock of it over. Well, Jim was dead set against it. He flatly refused, said absolutely not. He said he'd never expose his mother to that kind of talk. So I said, for God's sake, Jim, she was sitting right there during the first trial. She's already heard it. Not from me, she hasn't, he said. So I thought a minute, and I said, how about if your mother is not in the courtroom when you testify? Then she won't hear it from you. Jim finally came around. He agreed to do it. I told him not to worry, we'll back him up by picking a jury that's not biased against homosexuals. How do you plan to do that? I asked. Siler leaned forward, putting his elbows on the desk. Well, Coach, this is what we're going to do. When we interview prospective jurors, we're going to ask them, would you have a problem if you learned that a defendant was a homosexual? They'll all say, oh, no, no problem at all. Then we'll ask them, would you want a homosexual teaching your children at school? Right there, we'll trap a lot of them. Well, no, they'll say, I wouldn't want that, and we'll strike those people for cause. If they slip past that question, we'll hit them with, are there any homosexuals in your church? Then, would you mind if your minister was a homosexual? If there's any bias, we'll dig it out sooner or later. Siler was not interested in seeking a change of venue. We might be very sorry if we got it, he said. There's no telling where we'd end up trying this case. We'd have no control over it. We could find ourselves in Ware County. He rolled his eyes. All they got there are a bunch of damn rednecks. I mean, hell, people over there think it's a sin to have sex with the lights on. They'd lynch Jim before they ever got around to convicting him. So I think we're better off right here in Savannah. The DA's case isn't as strong as he makes it out to be, and it's getting weaker all the time. How? I ventured to ask. Well, I'll tell you. Lawton likes to talk about the overwhelming physical evidence against Jim. That's bullshit. He's got two pet theories, the gunshot residue theory and the coup de grace theory. He claims the absence of gunshot residue on Danny's hands proves he didn't fire a gun, and he says Danny was lying on the floor when Jim shot him in the back. Well, we've come up with brand new evidence that knocks hell out of both those arguments. I don't mind telling you what we've got, 'cause we've had to share it all with the DA. Last month, we got a court order that allowed us to have our own experts conduct laboratory tests on the two German Lugers, Jim's and Danny's, and the shirt that Danny was wearing. We lined up one of the top forensic pathologists in the country to do the tests, Dr. Irving Stone of the Institute for Forensic Sciences in Dallas. He's the guy who analyzed the clothing worn by President Kennedy and Governor Connally for the congressional committee that re-examined the Kennedy assassination. In other words, he's no slouch. Now, we were sticking our neck out, 'cause we didn't know whether Stone's findings would help us or hurt us, and we were under court order to give the results to Lawton. In fact, the DA sent his man with us to Dallas, Dr. Larry Howard, the director of the Georgia Crime Lab. Old Doc Howard carried the guns and the shirt down there. Well, when Dr. Stone stepped up to test fire Danny's pistol, something unexpected happened. It wouldn't fire. At first, Stone thought the safety was on, but it turned out that the trouble was that the gun had an unusually heavy trigger pull, 20 pounds. A normal trigger pull is 4 to 6 pounds. Stone had to squeeze hard to pull the trigger, and as he did, the gun jerked around drastically. Right there, we had an unlooked-for explanation for why Danny missed Jim and shot into the desk. It was a bonus. It just fell into our lap. Then, Dr. Stone went ahead and tested the gun to see if it was consistent in the way it threw off gunpowder. Get this. Stone found that when he held Danny's gun in a downward angle and fired it, as Danny would have, the gunshot residue was diminished by more than half. Not only that, The gun was erratic in the amount of residue it threw off.
Well, old Doc Howard was breathing heavy right about now.
Then Dr. Stone ran an analysis of Danny's shirt. Hell, there wasn't any gunpowder on it at all. According to Stone, that proves Jim had to be standing at least 4 feet away from Danny, because that's how far Jim's gun ejects debris out the front of the barrel. Stone says that means there's no way Jim could have come around the desk to fire the last two shots, because there'd be gunpowder on Danny's shirt if he had. So much for Lawton's coup de grace theory.
I thought old Doc Howard was going to pass out.
Siler pulled a manila envelope out of his desk drawer. Now I'm going to show you a little surprise we have in store for Lawton. After the police got to Jim's house, they photographed the room where the shooting took place. Those pictures showed all sorts of supposedly incriminating details, right? A chair leg on Danny Hansford's trousers, particles of paper on top of the gun on the desk, smeared blood on Danny's wrist. Bad stuff. Lawton introduced about 20 photographs in the first trial, but the police photographer testified she took 5 rolls. That means there were over 100 pictures we hadn't seen. A couple of weeks ago, we asked to have a look at the rest of them. We didn't know what we were looking for, and frankly, we didn't think we'd find anything. Well, we got the full set of photographs a couple of days ago. Okay, now look at this one. Siler handed me a photograph showing the chair behind Williams's desk. A leather pouch lay on the carpet against a leg of the chair. Now compare that photograph with this one. In the second shot, the leather pouch was no longer touching the chair leg. It was several inches away. You can tell from the designs in the carpet that both the chair and the leather pouch have been moved. I don't know who moved them or why, but nobody is supposed to touch anything at the scene of an alleged crime until photography is completed and measurements are taken. If the police do move anything, they're required to photograph it actually being moved, and they didn't. When we looked through the rest of the pictures, this is the sort of thing we found. Siler laid out several other photographs showing objects on the top of Williams's desk. Notice the position of the pink box here and here. The pink box, too, had been moved. So had a copy of TV Guide, a stack of envelopes, rolls of paper, and a telephone directory. When you look at all the pictures, and not just the 20 the DA used for the first trial, you can see that things were being shuffled around all over the place. That means the scene of the shooting was never properly secured. There's not supposed to be anybody in the room when the police photographer is shooting pictures, but just look at these photographs. You can see feet, arms, legs, civilian shoes, uniform shoes, black shoes, felt shoes. The police were swarming all over the house that night. It was a convention. And now we discover they were moving the evidence. That's crazy. It violates rudimentary police procedure. What's more, it taints all the evidence in the room. Siler beamed. I tell you, we're in good shape. The only thing out of our control is Jim's arrogance on the witness stand. But hell, we ain't never going to get around that. We're just going to have to live with it. Siler tilted back in his chair and clasped his hands behind his head. Lawton's in trouble, but it's his own fault. He made a terrible blunder playing keep away with the evidence in the first trial. Lawton's articulate and smart, no question, but he doesn't have the experience a DA ought to have. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about. I've been practicing law for 25 years, been in court dozens and dozens of times. Spencer Lawton hasn't handled but 2 court cases in his life, the Rangers case and Jim's first trial, and he hasn't won one yet, now that Jim's conviction has been reversed. He's anxious, and he's green, and we're going to take advantage of that. We've been keeping the pressure on him, swamping him with pre-trial motions, distracting him with details. There's nothing we can do about the horrendous publicity, of course, but this time we're going to sequester the jury to shield them from it. I hate to do it to them, but we'll try to speed things up a little by having Saturday sessions in court."
Siler shook his head.
"Right in the middle of football season, too. That ought to prove I didn't make the decision lightly. I've been to every Georgia home game for the last 25 years. I figure I'll miss at least one game, maybe two this year because of the trial. But we'll be at the opener against UCLA this Saturday."
"You and Ugga?"
"Yep," said Siler. "Ever seen Ugga?" "No, but I've heard about him."
"People love Ugga," he said. "He's the most famous animal in Georgia."
Siler gestured toward a bank of file cabinets next to his desk.
"That whole thing is full of nothing but Ugga."
He began rolling out the drawers. They were crammed with clippings, photographs, posters, letters.
"Last year, Ugga went to the Heisman Trophy Award dinner in New York," he said. "Did you hear about that? Here, look."
Siler pulled out an AP wire photo of himself and Ugga IV with Herschel Walker, the Georgia halfback who had won the Heisman Trophy that year. The three of them, the dog included, were wearing black tie.
"Ugga's the only dog ever to be invited to a Heisman dinner," he said brightly.
He continued wading through the files.
"Ugga's correspondence is amazing. When he had an operation on his knee, he got hundreds of get-well cards from all over the country. There's a file of them somewhere in here. He even got a card from Mike the Tiger."
"Who's Mike the Tiger?" I asked. Siler looked up from the cabinet, surprised at my ignorance.
"LSU," he said.
He pressed the intercom.
"Betty, you got that file with Ugga's get-well cards. I can't find it."
Siler's secretary came into the room with a worried look.
"It should be in there, Sonny," she said.
She opened another drawer and looked through it. Then she left the room. Siler went on rummaging, thoroughly engrossed. Meanwhile, I glanced around the room. A life-size porcelain bulldog lounged on the hearth. Above it, a procession of carved bulldogs prowled across the mantelpiece in bas-relief. Scattered here and there were other objects of bulldogiana, framed snapshots, a brass paperweight, figurines, needlepoint pillows. Betty came back into the room.
"I think this is it, Sonny," she said.
She gave him a file labeled knee injury. Scores of cards and letters fell out onto the desk. Siler began to paw through them.
"Here it is," he said. "Mike the Tiger. And here's one from the Boston College Eagle, the Kentucky Wildcat, Mrs. Willingham's fourth grade class in Macon."
Some of the letters ran to several pages. Siler held up a handful.
"I tell you, Ugga's a phenomenon. Ugga III even made it into the animal's who's who. He was the mascot when we won the national championship a couple of years ago."
Siler went over to the bookshelf and took down the book. Indeed, Ugga III was immortalized in it, along with Rin Tin Tin, Man o' War, Moby Dick, Toto, and the White Rabbit. I put the book down on Siler's desk, which was now awash in Ugga memorabilia.
"You know," said Siler, looking up from the pile, "you ought to try to make it up to Athens this weekend. We're playing UCLA. Ought to see at least one game while you're here. If you do, come on by the hotel suite around noon. We always have a little gathering before the game. That's when Ugga gets dressed."
On Saturday morning, traffic flowed north toward Athens with the exuberance of a cavalry charge. Red and black pennants fluttered from aerials. Homemade signs flashed messages of common cause. "Go Bulldogs! Beat UCLA! How about them dogs?" At noon, a dozen guests were gathered in Sonny Siler's hotel suite. A radio on the dresser was tuned to a pre-game call-in question-and-answer show. Siler sat on the edge of the bed, talking on the telephone. He wore a red sweater, black slacks, and a white baseball cap inscribed with the letter G.
He was shouting into the receiver.
"That's you, Rima? Can you hear me? We all up here listening to the damn talk show, but you ain't called in yet. They got a bunch of crackers calling in. Huh? Oh, hell, they just asking dumb questions like, when do we wear white pants and when do we wear red, and how many conference games has Georgia lost in red trousers? You gonna call in? It's that 800 number I gave you. You got it? Okay, coach, we'll be listening for you."
Sonny got up from the bed. That was Rima Lane. He's back in Savannah. Gonna call that radio show with a question about Ugga. At this moment, Ugga himself was reclining on a basket in the shower stall, an enormous heap of furry white wrinkles surrounded by a cluster of admirers, including Siler's daughter, Swan.
"Hey, baby, hey, sweetie,"
a woman cooed.
"You gonna pull us through today, sugar?"
Sonny went to a makeshift bar on the dresser and poured several drinks.
"I tell you," he said, "I got every bit of faith in this team. We gonna have another winning season, but I sure do miss Herschel."
"Amen," said a man in a red blazer.
Herschel Walker had played his last season the previous year and was now a rookie with the New Jersey Generals.
"We'll do okay," another man said, "but I'm already beginning to sweat the Florida game. Not the outcome of the game, mind you, the tickets. Everybody wants tickets. I'm usually pretty good at finding them, and everybody and his brother seems to know that. But I mean, Jesus, it's only September and it's already started."
"September?" said a man in a red and black windbreaker. "My phone usually starts ringing around the middle of July, and that's no exaggeration. Then come August, it really heats up. I get phone calls, I get interoffice memos, I get telegrams, I get letters. I'm the most popular man in Georgia when it comes to the Georgia-Florida game."
Most of the men in the room were well-connected football fans, and now they traded stories about getting tickets for friends.
"Hey, Sonny," one of them called out. "What about that Williams murder case? You figure you're gonna win it?"
Siler looked at the man.
"Is Georgia gonna beat UCLA?"
Georgia was heavily favored.
"I tell you, coach," said Siler, "don't go placing any bets against us yet. We got a couple of surprises up our sleeve. New evidence, a couple of new witnesses. It's gonna be a... Oh, wait, there it is."
Siler reached over and turned up the volume on the radio.
"Of course Ugga has a big appetite," the announcer was saying, "and our caller from Savannah wants to know, what brand of dog food does Ugga eat?" "Attaboy, Rima," said Siler.
Everyone in the room knew the answer. Jim Dandy dog ration. Ugga not only ate Jim Dandy dog ration, but he officially endorsed it, too. Plastic cups were raised in a toast to Ugga Four and Jim Dandy. Swan Siler poked her head in the door.
"Daddy, it's time to dress Ugga."
"Ah, the dressing of the dog,"
intoned a portly man standing by the window. Siler held up a red jersey and called out,
"Hee-ah!"
Ugga came trotting into the room, wriggling and wagging his 65-pound body. Siler slipped the jersey over his head and fastened a spiked collar around his neck.
"If we have a defeat," said Swan, "then we don't ever wear that jersey again. Sometimes if things aren't going well, we change jerseys in the middle of a game."
"We've got five or six with us today," said Sonny. "We can change if we have to. I hope we don't."
"Mom used to make them," said Swan. "We've got some historical jerseys that Ugga wears when we've won bowl games. Ugga's got a bigger wardrobe than I do."
The guests started putting on their coats as Siler brushed the dog and sprinkled talcum powder on the top of his head to cover a grayish spot.
"That's for the cameras," he said. "He's supposed to be a picture-perfect, all-white dog. Well, let's go."
He opened the door, and Ugga surged down the hall, straining on his leash, and leading the procession to the elevator and out through the lobby. In the parking lot outside Sanford Stadium, Siler lifted Ugga onto the roof of his red station wagon, the one with the Ugga 4 license plates. Thus enthroned, Ugga accepted the adoration of his fans. Thousands of spectators waved, called his name, patted him on the head, and took snapshots on their way to the stadium. Ugga wiggled and panted, and licked as many hands as he could reach. Shortly before kickoff, Siler took Ugga down from his perch and led him around to the open end of the U-shaped stadium. He and Ugga paused just outside the end zone, in front of three marble tombstones set into a landscaped embankment. This was the Ugga Memorial Plot. Bunches of flowers had been placed at the foot of each tombstone, and each bore an inscription to a late Ugga. Ugga. Undefeated, untied. 6 bowl teams. Damn good dog. 1956-1967. Ugga 2. 5 bowl teams. Not bad for a dog. 1968-1972. Ugga 3. Undefeated, untied, undisputed, and undenied. National champions of college football 1980. How about this dog? The band was assembling in the end zone. The Georgia cheerleaders came to take Ugga from Siler and put him into his official doghouse, which was shaped like a big red fire hydrant on wheels. It was air-conditioned, the Georgia heat being less than ideal for Ugga's breed of English bulldog. The hydrant was wheeled out to midfield for the opening ceremonies. Just before kickoff, Ugga jumped out and trotted to the sidelines. A roar went up from the crowd. Damn good dog! Damn good dog! Damn good dog! Roof! 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 Later that evening, I called Williams to tell him about my conversations with Siler. "It sounds as if he's come up with strong new ammunition for you," I said. "I would think so," said Williams, "considering the rates he charges. What did you think of him?" "Smart, energetic, committed to your case." "Hmm," said Williams, "and to the money he's making from it." I could hear the clinking of ice cubes at Williams's end of the line. "Do you want me to explain what he's got?" "No, not especially. But tell me, not that I really care about this either, who won the game today?" "Georgia, 19-8. "Good," said Williams. "That means Sonny will be in high spirits. It's all so childish. When Georgia loses, it absolutely destroys him. He goes into shock and can't function for days." "In that case, I think you'll get a vigorous defense out of him. It was a solid victory." "Not too big a victory, I hope. He might regard my trial as an anticlimax." "I don't think the game was that important," I said. "It wasn't a Southeastern Conference game." "Wonderful," said Williams. "I wouldn't want him to be all distracted and daydreaming. I want him to be frisky, yes." "That should work." Williams paused. The ice cubes clinked. "Yes. That should work very well." Chapter 21. Notes on a Rerun. This is not a happy jury. 6 men, 6 women. 7 black, 5 white. When Judge Oliver told them to go home and come back in the morning with enough clothes for a 2-week stay, 4 of the women burst into tears. One of the men jumped up and shouted, "I refuse it! I refuse it! I'll lose work! It will make me hostile to the case!" Another man bolted for the door and had to be restrained by the bailiffs. "You can take me to jail!" he screamed. "I'm not serving!" The judge summoned the 6 recalcitrant jurors to his chambers and listened to their complaints. Then he told them to go home and pack. Spencer Lawton leads off with the police photographer, Sergeant Donna Stevens, who gives a photographic tour of Mercer House using huge blow-ups on an easel. "This is an outside shot of the house," she says. "This is the living room. This is the hallway, and that's a grandfather clock dumped over. This is the doorway to the study, showing the victim laying on the floor. This is a shot of blood on the carpet." When she is finished, Siler steps up for cross-examination. "Do you remember photographing a pouch and a chair leg?" "Yes," she says. "Did you photograph it when you first got there?" "Yes, sir, I did." "And did you photograph it again after the detectives and other people had been stirring around in there?" "Yes." Siler holds up the two photographs, showing the pouch and the chair leg in different positions. "I'm interested in the traveling pouch," he says, raising an eyebrow. Sergeant Stevens concedes that the chair has been moved, but she denies that the pouch has been moved. Siler asks if, by looking at the designs on the carpet, she can see that indeed the pouch too has been moved. No, she does not see any such thing. Siler keeps at it. "Well, let's look at the first picture and count the dots in the carpet," he says. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. "And in the second picture, there are only 2 dots, right?" Sergeant Stevens grudgingly admits that the pouch has also been moved. The jury is entertained by Siler's self-assured courtroom manner. He strides back and forth, impeccably groomed in custom-tailored suits, French cuffs, highly polished shoes. He thunders and growls. His tone shifts from curiosity to sarcasm to outrage to surprise. Lawton is dull by comparison. He stands flat-footed in a rumpled suit. His manner is shy and unassuming. He flinches whenever Siler shouts, "Objection! Mr. Lawton is leading the witness again!" Siler does this repeatedly, to unnerve Lawton, and send a message to the jury that the DA lacks a grasp of basic courtroom procedure. At Clary's drugstore, Ruth wonders out loud whether this trial will be as juicy as the first. Luther Driggers says he thinks Williams made a mistake after shooting Hansford.
"He should have taken Danny's body out west, pulled his teeth, dissolved them in nitric acid, peeled off his skin, and fed it to the crabs."
"Why such a complicated cover-up?" Ruth asks. Luther shrugs.
"It beats leaving the body on the floor of Mercer House."
"Well, whatever Jim Williams should have done with the body, he's going about his defense the wrong way," says Quentin Lovejoy, putting his coffee cup down gently. Mr. Lovejoy is a soft-spoken classics scholar in his mid-60s. He lives with his maiden aunt in a high Victorian townhouse.
"All this talk about Danny Hansford being a violent, brutal criminal, Jim Williams does himself no credit blaspheming the boy that way."
"But Quentin," Ruth protests,
"Danny Hansford beat up his sister. His mother took out a police warrant against him. He'd been arrested umpteen times. He'd been in jail. He was a common criminal."
"Not at all," says Mr. Lovejoy in a voice slightly louder than a whisper. "The only crime that boy ever committed was turning 20. Siler objects to the repeated use of the term crime scene by prosecution witnesses. "It has not yet been established that any crime has been committed here," he says. Judge Oliver apparently doesn't hear Siler. In fact, the judge appears to be dozing. His eyes are closed, his chin is resting on his chest. The judge has made it abundantly clear, by heaving deep sighs and becoming increasingly cranky, that he is bored with this retrial. His apparent catnaps are causing comment in the courthouse. At any rate, he doesn't respond to Siler's protest. Less than a minute later, a prosecution witness says crime scene again, and Siler lets it pass. In the corridor, during a recess, a pair of purple glasses catches my eye. Minerva is sitting on a bench with a plastic shopping bag on her lap. I sit down next to her, and she tells me she has been asked to appear as a character witness for Williams. The defense hopes she will appeal to the 7 blacks on the jury. She will identify herself as a laundress, which is her part-time profession, but from the witness stand, she'll be in a position to make direct eye contact with the DA, the judge, and the members of the jury. This will enable her to put a curse on every one of them. While she waits, she sits out in the hall, humming and gurgling softly to herself. Occasionally, she cracks open the door and peers into the courtroom. Danny Hansford's mother, Emily Bannister, also sits in the corridor. Sonny Seiler has listed her as a defense witness, just as Bobby Lee Cook did, in order to keep her out of the courtroom. She's quiet and composed, and it strikes me that Seiler's main concern is not that she will cause a disturbance in front of the jury, but that her waif-like appearance will win their hearts. In any case, she still refuses to talk to the press, or to me. As the trial progresses, Mrs. Bannister sits in the corridor just outside the courtroom door, reading, writing notes in a journal, and needle-pointing. The first Saturday in court, both Sonny Seiler and Judge Oliver appear to be on edge. They're worried about the Georgia-Mississippi State game, which is taking place concurrently in Athens. Seiler stations an associate in the corridor, listening to the play-by-play on a portable radio. Oliver, a past president of the University of Georgia Club, asks Seiler to keep him advised of the situation. Seiler does so during whispered conferences at the bench. Georgia wins, 20-7. Monday morning. Williams testifies. Standing outside the courtroom beforehand, he appears relaxed. "Sonny called me last night to tell me to act humble and remorseful," he says. "I don't know if I can manage that, but I am making a sincere effort to look impoverished. I'm wearing the same blue blazer I wore on Friday. It will give the jury the impression I haven't got anything else to wear. What they won't know is that it's a custom-made Dunhill jacket and that the buttons are 18-carat Georgia gold." Seiler puts his new game plan into effect. Before Williams takes the stand, his sister escorts his mother out of the courtroom. On direct examination, Seiler asks Williams to explain his relationship with Danny Hansford. "He was a nice fellow," Williams says. "He could be charming. He had his girlfriend, I had mine. But to me, sex is just a natural thing. We'd had sex a few times. Didn't bother me, didn't bother him. I had my girlfriend and he had his. It was just an occasional, natural thing that happened." The expressions on the jurors' faces suggest they do not find this arrangement natural at all. Lawton steps up to cross-examine Williams. Williams regards him with undisguised contempt. "You indicated that you and Hansford had sex from time to time," says Lawton. "Is that right?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And that you feel that sex is a perfectly natural thing?" "Well, you see, it's not only just natural. At the time, Danny was a hustler on Bull Street, selling himself to anybody who wanted to pay for it."
"Exactly," says Lawton. "Right. So he was a street kid, and had been since 14 years of age, I think you indicated?"
"Oh, yes."
"An eighth-grade dropout and something on the order of 20 years old, is that right?"
"He was 21. He was no child."
"I wouldn't, of course, dispute your right to have any relationship you wanted to, but you were 52 and he was 21. Was that a natural and normal relationship?"
"Mm-hmm. I was 52 years old, but he had 52 years worth of mileage on him."
"I don't have anything else," said Lawton. "Thank you very much."
Williams's choice of words may not have been what Seiler had hoped for, but his frankness has made it unnecessary for Lawton to call Hansford's two friends in rebuttal. That, Siler believes, has spared Williams major damage. During a recess, Siler tells me Judge Oliver is old and tired. He's also terrified of being reversed by the state Supreme Court again, so he's allowing the defense to bring in a lot more evidence about Danny Hansford's history of violence than he did in the first trial.
"We wouldn't get half that stuff past a younger, more able judge," says Siler.
Barry Thomas, the foreman of Williams's shop, is one of the people permitted by Judge Oliver to tell a story about Hansford's violence. A slightly built Scotsman, Thomas recalls how, without warning and for no apparent reason, Hansford physically attacked him at Mercer House 2 months before he died.
"It was the end of the workday," Thomas says, "and I was getting ready to leave through the front door of Mercer House when I heard these footsteps behind me. I looked around and saw Mr. Hansford charging toward me. He just went at me and kicked me in the stomach. Jim grabbed him and pulled him off me and said, 'You better get out of here. Danny's gone crazy.' Well, a couple of days later, Mr. Hansford apologized for kicking me. He said he didn't know why he did it. He wanted me to kick him in the stomach in return, but I said no. I thought he was sick. I have no idea why he attacked me, other than it was just his nature."
Thomas steps down after testifying. As he goes out into the hall, a hand reaches up and grabs his ear. He lets out a sharp, "Aye!" as the door closes behind him. I slip into the corridor and see that the hand clutching his ear is Minerva's.
"Why did you say that?"
she hisses.
"Say what?"
says Thomas, grabbing hold of her arm.
"About the dead boy,"
she says, giving his ear a sharp yank.
"Why did you say that?"
"'Cause it's true," says Thomas. "He kicked me in the stomach for no good reason."
"That don't matter,"
she says, letting go of his ear.
"You got the boy angry again. Now we gotta calm him down."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Get me some parchment. I need a pen, too. One that's got red ink in it, and let me think, scissors, gotta have a scissors, and a candle and a Bible. I need him quick."
"Parchment?" Thomas asks. "Where am I gonna find—"
Minerva grabs him by the ear again. "I know where you can get a Bible," I say, stepping forward, "at the motel across the street." $5 coaxes a Bible and a candle out of the desk clerk at the motel. At Friedman's Art Supply Store, Thomas buys a red felt-tip pen and a package of heavy vellum tracing paper, which is the closest thing they have to parchment. When he starts to pay, Minerva puts her hand on his arm and stops him.
"Lay the money down on the table first," she says. "That way the lady can't work with your hand. Kiss it before you lay it down so it'll come back to you."
Thomas obediently kisses the money and lays it on the counter. Back in Thomas's car, Minerva spreads out her paraphernalia on the back seat and says,
"Take us as close as we can get to water."
Thomas drives down the steep cobblestone street leading from Factor's Walk to River Street. We move slowly along the River Street Esplanade, the docks on one side, the old warehouses on the other. Minerva points to an old three-masted schooner.
"Right there."
Thomas pulls to a stop at the ship's bow, and Minerva lights the candle and begins to chant. With the red pen, she scribbles phrases from the Bible onto the vellum. When she is done, she cuts the vellum into small squares and sets them on fire, one by one. Glowing ashes float around like black snowflakes inside the car.
"Take these three pieces I ain't burned,"
she says to Thomas,
"and tell Mr. Jim to put them in his shoes."
Suddenly, I become aware that there are four of us present, not three. The fourth is a policeman, who is looking in the window about a foot from my face.
Ma'am, he says. Minerva holds the burning candle in front of her face and stares at the policeman through her purple glasses. She opens her mouth wide. She says. Then she puts the candle in her mouth and closes her lips around it. As she does, the light sets her cheeks aglow like a jack-o'-lantern. The glow goes out with a sizzle. She hands the extinguished candle to the policeman.
"We ain't burning no more,"
she says softly. She taps Thomas on the shoulder, and, as we pull away, I can see the policeman in the side-view mirror. He is still holding the candle and looking blankly in our direction when we turn the corner. Back in the courtroom, a psychiatrist testifies that as a child, Danny Hansford was a breath holder. What he means by that, he says, is that Danny used to torment his mother by holding his breath until he turned blue and passed out. Minerva will not testify after all. She has suddenly realized that she knows one of the jurors, and he knows her.
"I done some black magic on him," she says. "He's still mad as hell."
She will not say what she did to him or why. Dr. Irving Stone, the forensic pathologist from Dallas, takes the stand and makes forceful arguments for the defense about the gunshot residue and other aspects of the shooting, as Siler said he would. His comments are supported by Joseph Burton, the medical examiner from Atlanta who testified in the first trial and has returned for this one. More compelling than their testimony, however, is the casual shop talk they engage in while waiting in the corridor to take the stand.
"I identified 357 bodies in that Delta crash we had in Dallas the other day," says Stone. "Got 30 a day. It took 12 days.
"Geez," says Burton. "Nice going. How many did you get from fingerprints?"
74%.
"How about dental records?"
"Can't remember. 10% maybe.
My favorite was the one I got from a pacemaker. Noted the serial number.
Called the manufacturer? Got the name that way."
Siler has saved his two surprise witnesses for late in the trial. Vanessa Blanton, a brunette in her mid-twenties, is a waitress at the 1790 restaurant and bar. She says she used to live in a townhouse on Monterey Square, and she remembers seeing a young man fire a pistol into the trees about a month before Danny Hansford was killed. She didn't know that this incident had any bearing on Williams's trial until recently, when a law associate of Sonny Siler's happened to overhear her mentioning the incident to another waitress at the restaurant. Siler subpoenaed her. She takes the witness stand.
"We closed the bar at 2:30, and I got in my car and went straight home. I was going up the stairs when I heard a gunshot. I looked over my shoulder toward Mr. Williams's house. It sounded as if it had come from that direction. There was a young man in blue jeans and a T-shirt holding a gun, pointing it toward the trees. He fired another shot."
"What did you do after that?" Siler asks.
"I opened the front door to go into my apartment, and when I looked back, I noticed the young man was going back up the front steps to Mr. Williams's house. Then I collected my thoughts for a minute, and I thought about calling the police, but when I looked out the window again, a police car was pulling up to the house."
Spencer Lawton sees Miss Blanton as a serious blow to his April 3 scenario. He challenges her ability to see the figure in front of Mercer House clearly at that distance and in the dark of night, but she sticks to her story. Siler's second surprise witness is Dina Smith, a blonde woman in her mid-30s. On the night Danny Hansford was shot, she was visiting Savannah from Atlanta and staying with her cousin just off Monterey Square. Sometime after 2 o'clock, she went out to sit on a bench in Monterey Square and enjoy the night air. "After I'd been in the square for some minutes, there were several loud gunshots fired all at once. It was very loud. It seemed to be coming from all around. I kind of just sat there, frozen. I looked around and remained in the square for 20 to 30 minutes, and then walked back across to the apartment.
Were there any police cars in front of Mr. Williams's house at that time? Siler asks.
No, sir. The front door was standing open. The lights were on.
All right, says Siler. Did you see anyone?
No, sir.
Did you call the police then?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
I wouldn't have known what to tell them. I didn't know what I had heard.
The next morning, Mrs. Smith left her cousin's house to go to the beach and saw a TV news van in front of Mercer House. She read about the shooting later and only then realized what had happened. Mrs. Smith says she was introduced to Williams by her cousin on a subsequent visit to Savannah while Williams was appealing his conviction. She told Williams what she had heard, and he asked her to speak to his lawyers. The import of what Dina Smith has to say is that all of the shots, as she heard them, were fired in rapid succession, just as Williams had said. There were no pauses, no time, if she is to be believed, for Williams to get a second gun and fake the shots from Hansford's side of the desk. The final day in court, a Saturday. On tap for today, closing arguments, the judge's instructions to the jury, the Georgia-Mississippi game. In his summation, Sonny Siler puts heavy emphasis on the clumsiness of the police at Mercer House, comparing them to the Keystone Cops.
They had so many people in Jim Williams's study while they were investigating the scene, they can't count them, he says. First, Corporal Anderson comes, and he brings a rookie cop along. Following them is Officer Traub, as I recall, and then they started coming out of the woodwork. In they come, one after another, I don't know how many, something like 14 in all, and it wasn't a matter of just coming. It was come and join the party, because you don't have many things like this happening in Savannah, in a historical mansion, with an environment of antiques and fine things and an air of mystery and intrigue. And they all go into the study at one time or another. Anderson, White, Chesler, Burns, Traub, Gibbons, Donna Stevens, all of them back and forth, in and out, all around the room. Everybody's curious, you see. They're picking things up and they're putting them down. And every expert on the stand, including their own, says that is not good investigative procedure. Yet they want you to believe they had some sacred veil over all the stuff while they took photographs. They tell you they secured the scene. Baloney. You've seen the pictures.
Lawton, in his closing statement, will not give up on the idea that Jim Williams staged the April 3rd incident in spite of what Vanessa Blanton says she saw. Lawton tells the jury, "If you believe Vanessa Blanton really saw Danny Hansford out there shooting in Monterey Square, then okay. But I will suggest to you that it may be very difficult to tell, down there in those shadows, whether what you're looking at is Danny Hansford or Jim Williams. We have to entertain the possibility that it was practice, a dry run that sets up Danny Hansford's violent nature within a month of when he gets killed." Of Dina Smith and the shots she heard on the park bench a month later, Lawton makes it clear he does not believe her. "I will suggest to you that she was a friend trying her best to help out in a pinch." Toward the end of the summation, Lawton engages in a bit of stage business concerning the 20-pound trigger pull on Danny's gun. "The defense tells us that when Danny Hansford fired at Williams and missed, it was because the trigger pull on his gun was so strong. So strong, indeed, that Dr. Stone, an ex-FBI agent and obviously no weakling, had to use two hands to fire it. I'd like to show you something, if I may." Lawton hands Danny's gun to his petite female assistant and asks her to point it toward the wall and pull the trigger. She does so with no effort at all and without jiggling the barrel a millimeter. Siler objects to the demonstration, but Oliver overrules him. After the closing arguments, Judge Oliver reads the jury its instructions. He offers three choices: guilty of murder, guilty of voluntary manslaughter, and not guilty. It is 5:30 p.m. when the jury retires to consider its verdict.